There's far too many of you dying.
You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today.
Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Good morning. I got to take myself off mute. Good morning, New York and New Jersey, as well as the great world beyond. This is Keziah Glow. This is the Tuesday edition of What's Going On, the Peace and Labor Report. Catherine Davis is our audio engineer and Bob Hennelly is our executive producer. It's August 6th, 2024. Sunrise was at 5:58 a.m. and sunset will be at 8:05 p.m. It's 77 degrees under cloudy skies, headed up to 88 degrees by later this afternoon. Thunderstorms will be developing this afternoon. Storms may contain strong, gusty winds. And Wednesday and Thursday, we can also expect rain and thunderstorms. So this morning, we continue our coverage of the ongoing crisis within health and hospitals. New York City's municipal hospital system is the largest in the nation. So that really means a lot. Health and hospitals serve all individuals, regardless of their insurance coverage or immigration status. We persist on covering this issue because the Doctors Council contract expired last year. So what does that mean? And the city's municipal hospitals and clinic networks have been facing a staffing crisis that is compromising patient care. Today, we will speak with Dr. Mike Jones, emergency department physician at Jacoby Hospital and training director for the largest new emergency physician training program in the country at Jacoby. And the second half of the show, we will discuss the resilient environments and landscape, real rules, R-E-A-L, which have been officially published in the New Jersey Register. These rules aim to address sea level rise, coastal storm surges, flooding, and stormwater management. Joining us will be Jennifer M. Coffey, Executive Director for the Association of New Jersey Environmental Commission. And we are going to cover all of this, plus take your calls. And you know, I want to hear from you. The telephone number is 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. I dare you to call and tell us what is on your mind. But first, we are going to go to Washington for the Pacifica Network News.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
As your future president, I know we are up to this fight. And when we fight, everyone will say in unison, we win.
Vice President Kamala Harris thanks delegates to the DNC as she officially secures enough votes to become the Democratic presidential nominee. The tally was made official Monday night after a five-day round of online balloting. Meanwhile, Harris is expected to announce her running mate in Philadelphia today when they kick off a tour of battleground states. Arizona's largest public school district will no longer host polling places on Election Day. Mesa school officials say growing voter distrust has led to staff being harassed. Watchdogs tie that to inflammatory rhetoric, as when Arizona's GOP Senate candidate Carrie Lake tells her supporters to arm themselves with what she calls the armor of God.
Then maybe strap on a Glock on the side of us just in case. You can put one here and one in the back or one in the front, whatever you guys decide.
Meanwhile, Maricopa County officials are scrambling to find replacement polling sites, including privately owned spaces and shopping malls. Arizona's attorney general says former Trump campaign lawyer Jenna Ellis has agreed to cooperate with election subversion prosecutors. Ellis was charged with multiple felonies for arranging fake electors who could claim 2020 was stolen and contest the Electoral College results. After pleading guilty in a similar Georgia case, Ellis said she regretted taking part.
If I knew then what I know now, I would have declined to represent Donald Trump in these post-election challenges. I look back on this whole experience with deep remorse.
A new South Dakota law gives partisan poll watchers more power on Election Day. Polling places now have to make sure these volunteers can witness everything except for the actual marking of ballots. Andrew Garber with the Brennan Center for Justice says it could lead to voter intimidation or workers threatened with misdemeanor arrest.
When poll workers can be subject to criminal penalties, it means poll watchers are going to feel empowered to push the boundaries. And in some cases, people are no longer going to want to serve as poll workers.
Louisiana officials are asking a federal court to dismiss a lawsuit against a new law requiring the Ten Commandments be posted in every public classroom. A group of parents and civil rights activists say forcing the religious text upon students is unconstitutional, but Governor Jeff Landry says if they don't like it, they don't have to look.
Many religions share and recognize the Ten Commandments as a whole. So really and truly, I don't see what the whole big fuss is about.
And an initiative now approved for the ballot could bring ranked choice voting to the nation's capital. Supporters say it would make politicians running in Washington, D.C. work harder to reach previously ignored voters. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Okay, thank you for that. So, Dr. Mike, welcome to our show. Dr. Mike Jones, are you on the line?
Hi, good morning, Kezia. Nice to hear from you.
Great, great, great. So I just got to correct you really quickly. It's Keziah. Just got to tell you
so
that
sorry.
Really quick.
No worries. I appreciate that.
No worries. Let me tell you, that is one of the biggest things. And I am always correcting people. It's okay. So we're just going to jump right in. So Dr. Mike Jones, welcome. We've been covering this topic and we are eager to learn about current developments. This has been something that we have been listening and having a discussion about for a while now. But first, before we get into any new developments, I would love for you to share a bit about your background and what inspired you to become an advocate and trainer for others.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. I guess, how did I get into this? Once upon a time, my parents, my grandparents inspired me to do something good. And somewhere along the lines, I actually became an EMT. And very shortly thereafter, very terrible day happened, terrible day for me and certainly one for New York, September 11th. I was a rescue worker that day, an EMT working at Ground Zero, was there for that day, the days and weeks after. It inspired me to help our communities in our greatest time of need. I joined the New York City Health and Hospital System at Jacoby a few years later, became an intern, a resident physician, and have remained on faculty in our department, in the emergency department. Spent almost 25 years, more than half my life, basically in service of the people of New York City. And it's really, it's a great honor.
Yeah, you know what? It is an honor. It's an honor to have you on because, I was going to get into this later on in the discussion, but last week we had the privilege of speaking with the president of ASHME, DC 37, Local 3621, which represents FDNY EMS officers. And they are also currently awaiting an updated contract. So I was actually going to get into this later in the discussion, but learning that you actually started off as an EMT EMS officer, tell us what your insight is on their situation.
Absolutely. Well, I think, I don't know a ton about the specific details of their contract, but I know that they are locked in the same battle, the same fight that we are, looking for a fair and equitable contract. Our pre-hospital providers, our EMS, EMTs, paramedics, and officers, they do incredible work in individuals' homes in difficult environments. and in the back of ambulances, and they are looking to be treated fairly and appropriately, just the same way we are, the physicians in the emergency department. And we are in lockstep and in support of DC 37 and their contract negotiations.
Mm-hmm. You know, tell us what inspired you and your colleagues to, you know, do the work that you are doing and, you know, not step away and go to, you know, higher paying positions or private firms and things of that nature.
Absolutely. Well, you know, what inspires me, I think it's quite simple. It's the people, it's the community of New York. It's the individuals that live and work around our hospital, around Jacoby, that are coming, not because they want to, because they have to, because they have no place else to turn. They are looking for a helping hand. They are looking for insight into what ails them. They're looking for direction, and they're looking for hope. And on top of that, being able to help that individual person, I also get to work side by side other doctors, nurses, and others who are similarly inspired to give back to communities that are greatly in need.
So this is patients over profit.
Absolutely, 100%.
This is something that, you can't buy this. You can't buy that. I just want to invite everyone to definitely call in to this conversation. It's 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. Now, we understand that, the stall contract negotiations have resulted in low retention rates among hospital staff and challenges in recruitment and new doctors. How does this situation impact patients' care and the outcome?
It absolutely does impact patient care and outcomes. People wait. They wait to see an emergency room doctor. If you're having a heart attack, you can't wait. They wait to see a primary care physician. If you need to get your medications refilled or understand a new disease, you can't wait. They wait for subspecialty care. One example, rheumatology. Rheumatology is a disease treat musculoskeletal diseases like lupus. Did you know there are no rheumatologists at Jacoby? Lupus is a disease that affects predominantly Black and Hispanic communities. Almost 40% of patients who are affected with lupus are Black, 20% Hispanic. It's a top 10 cause of death in young Black and Hispanic individuals. We have none of them at Jacoby, a working class, diverse community, not one rheumatologist here. And why? Because the individual left. She was recruited to another private system and really just that's a shame for our community, unfortunately.
Okay. So, you know, and this is something that many of our listeners may feel like, well, actually not WBAI listeners. I'm going to stop right there. Many people besides WBAI listeners, because we actually have very informed, educated listeners. But many people may say, you know what, this really doesn't affect me. If you live in New York City and you have to call 911, chances are you will be using one of the municipal hospitals. Is that correct?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. The 11 hospitals in the health and hospital system is the largest in the country, and that's the most likely place you will go if you get on a, call 911 and go via an ambulance.
So although New York City hospitals are accessible to all residents, is there a concern regarding equity given that a higher proportion of users are Black and Latino?
I think, yes, there absolutely is a concern about equity. Our issues in terms of recruiting and retaining physicians, they are directly impacting the equity of care that our minority communities, our Black and Latino community members access. And I just gave you an example of a disease where care is not equitable. And there are other diseases I know that last I think it was last week, the week before, we spoke about maternal mortality, another example of diseases. Pregnant women who are Black or Latino are more likely to have bad outcomes. And in our healthcare system in New York City, if we don't recruit and retain effective physicians, we are essentially we are essentially institutionalizing the bias that exists in those types of diseases by not providing efficient and equitable care to all individuals.
Mm-hmm. You know, in the 21st century healthcare economy, there's a significant emphasis on reducing hospital stays. So that also lends to maternal care, right? Because, you know, they want you to then leave. You know, are you seeing less care in the maternal care space in that area? You know, are they encouraging faster discharges, meaning, you know, you just had a baby, it's time for you to go? What are you seeing in that area?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think we can all acknowledge that the best place for any patient to be is not in the hospital. While we love taking care of people here in the hospital, we want to get you home to your families and to your loved ones to be able to care for your young baby, to be with, you know, your family members in those moments. But we want to make certain we can do it safely and make certain that we've addressed all of the critical issues. The rush to discharge that is occurring in terms of reducing hospital stays, it is predominantly based in finance. It is not based in excellent care. There are some care improvements that can occur, but with an issue of recruiting and retaining physicians in our system, it makes it harder. The pressures are even more enormous. The push to get people out the door when we are understaffed and overwhelmed, we don't want to make a mistake, and yet it is possible. And so we're very concerned about this, and it directly speaks to many of the issues that we have in our contract campaign and trying to get New York City Health and Hospitals and Mayor Adams to fully fund our institutions, our healthcare institutions in New York City.
And then, you know, it's just really interesting because when this type of pressure is placed on the doctors, what are we seeing? What type of issues do we see when there are enough doctors? And they're saying that the rates of emergency visits are up. So there are more people coming in to see doctors. And we've had this conversation before. And I say, we never know when we're going to have to go into one of these hospitals, because usually you don't know when you're going to need to go into the emergency room. So if the rates are up, we spoke about this with the EMS officers. What are some of the results that you're seeing, the side effects from this?
Absolutely. Well, when the rates are up, the results are very clear. But let me back up just one second. Here at Jacoby, we just had our busiest month in the emergency department ever in July. And it is only August 6th, and we are on pace to have our busiest month again ever. We have month on month continuously seen an increase in the volume of patients coming to the emergency department for care. Not only that, we are seeing an increase in the acuity, how sick people are. People are sicker because they are delaying care because they don't have access to primary care. And so they come to our emergency department in greater volume and with more complicated and difficult problems. When we have problems of staffing throughout the entire house, the entire hospital, it bottlenecks in the emergency department. And so care is delayed. We don't get to that critically ill patient quickly enough. Studies, CAT scans, x-rays, all of those things that can find a life-threatening diagnosis are delayed. We have a lack of beds upstairs because we're not able to efficiently move people outside. And so patients who suffer from major trauma wait in the emergency department. We provide the best care possible. I don't want to say that people are not getting great care, but the stresses, the pressures that we feel, people get up and they walk out when they can. What do they say? They say, I'm going to get out and walk across the street. Well, across the street is a private hospital. that is better staffed and more efficient, because the private hospital has invested in those issues. And so it can be a very difficult situation. And while we are always up for the challenge and want to support our communities, our patients, we simply just need the resources. And again, you know, we really need the city, New York City Health and Hospitals, and Mayor Adams to really recognize this problem and recognize it as a fundamental problem to the health and well-being of all of New York.
Thank you. We have a caller on the line. Let's go ahead and take the caller. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. So you made a statement that people of color and Hispanics are more susceptible of getting lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. Has there been any type of study identifying the cause of this? Because it wouldn't be genetic. We're not born with this lupus. How is it that we are more susceptible of getting lupus than any other ethnic group?
Well, thank you and good morning. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, by the way.
Mitch.
Mitch, nice to meet you. Dr. Mike. Well, Mitch, you know, it's a great question. Why is it that people of color, black and Hispanic individuals, are more susceptible to lupus? I'm going to be real honest. That's not my wheelhouse. I'm not a rheumatologist. I'm not a geneticist. But what I can tell you is that all diseases have certain prevalences. They are more prominent, more common in certain patient populations. I use the example of lupus because it is one that afflicts our community greatly, and one that we do not have equitable care for those individuals. But there are many other diseases out there that affect different people of different origins, different ethnicities, different races. And what the exact cause, it can be very difficult to say whether it is actually genetic, whether it is environment or other. So I apologize. I don't have a great answer for you, but I do appreciate the question. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Mitch. Okay. All right. So, you know, I do appreciate the question because, you know, we would like to drill down further and find out more information on that. But what you did say was the specialist who would tend to that is no longer there. And that says a lot. You know, I'll share some personal experience. I grew up visiting Jacoby Hospital, and I actually used to go there because I had ear infections as a child. And Jacoby has been long renowned for their care and their expertise. Like, this was a really, really good hospital. And I'm not saying that it's not still a good hospital, but what we are saying is that there is a shortage and the doctors are not being able to be retained. They're going to private hospitals. And so the sad part of this story is the if you are in a neighborhood where or a community where there are higher populations of lupus and you don't have the specialists on hand, then what does that say about the actual hospital and the care that it's giving to the surrounding neighborhoods? That becomes a problem. Do you just want to elaborate on that?
Absolutely. So I am incredibly honored that you you used Jacoby. Your family has used Jacoby. We're honored to be able to help you and your family when you need. And you know, I think to your points, we are committed to providing excellent care. And I don't want our listeners to think that we are not doing that. We are doing it every single day. We provide the best care possible. We are struggling, though. We want to maintain the excellent levels of care that we provide. We want to provide private hospital level care in the public health care system. But we are at a breaking point. The healthcare system is really struggling. Our doctors, our physicians are struggling to continue to provide care in the environment that we work. and with the working conditions that are being provided to us. And so we hope that we will have a positive outcome in this negotiation, because it is important not just to us, it is important to all of New York that we have excellent physicians that can take care of you when you are either just, you know, for your regular care, or when you are having a difficult moment and you do need to seek emergency care or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. So. Absolutely. Absolutely. We're going to just take one more caller and then we're going to wrap up this segment. And I really do appreciate you joining us. Is there one more caller available? Okay. Hello? Okay, I'm not hearing anything. So
hello,
if
Brother David.
Oh, okay, you said David?
This is Brother David from Brooklyn.
Oh, Brother David, thank you so much. Do you have a question?
Yes, I have a question. I was in a situation where I had a stroke, and the point is that the EMS people took me to a hospital that could not handle someone with a stroke. So I know the state of New York has designated hospitals as stroke centers. And I'm wondering how that happened to me, where they took me to a hospital that couldn't handle a stroke patient and wasn't on the state list as a stroke center hospital. So I'm just wondering if improvements can be made so EMS workers can take a person with certain things like strokes to the right hospitals that can have, that has a stroke team, and then can take care of the patient, because every hospital is not the same.
Okay, thank you, Brother David.
Absolutely. Well, Brother David, thank you. Appreciate you calling in. And from Brooklyn, you're actually the farthest place in New York from me right now. I'm in the Bronx. But let me talk a little bit about stroke care. Stroke is one of those things that is, it's a time-sensitive, critical diagnosis. Now, every emergency department in New York City and New York State is equipped to recognize and initially treat a stroke. What every center is not equipped to do is the comprehensive, complete level of care from the door to the rehabilitation center that you might need on discharge. And that requires special doctors. It requires emergency physicians who are specially trained. It requires neurologists who have special training. It requires physiatrists, people who help you get your strength back. And all of those doctors, we centralize them in certain hospitals to be able to provide the most robust care. But the reality is those specialists, they are very highly trained, and they are very desirable for our private hospital systems. And so they are basically poaching all of these types of physicians. We're not able to retain those types of individuals. The stroke neurologist, the physiatrist that helps you after you've gotten over the acute phase. And so we want to improve stroke care and make certain that people like you are improving and on a trajectory to getting home, on a pathway to get back home. But without the doctors and the specialists in our system, we're not able to do that.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, Brother David, for calling in. Dr. Mike, thank you for joining us on this Tuesday edition of What's Going On, Peace and Labor Edition. I did not get into the training that you are doing. And the training is huge, because you are building and teaching new doctors, new physicians. So, you know, you're the director for the largest new emergency physician training program in the country at Jacoby. So when you come back next time, I would really like to get into the training aspect of your work, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. Well, I'm happy to come back and talk again. And I really appreciate the time and the opportunity to speak with you. Thank you again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One last thing. What can we do to support the Doctors Council EIU.
Absolutely. I think the biggest thing, we have a contract action campaign available on our website, doctorsforallnyc.org. We encourage you to speak to your local politicians, to your community boards, to anyone that is willing to listen, and tell them that you want to support the New York City Health and Hospital System and to fund the physicians and the providers fully so that we can recruit and retain excellent doctors to care for all of New York City.
Thank you, Dr. Mike Jones, emergency department physician at Jacoby. Thank you.
Thank you again. Appreciate it.
Okay. So you are listening to What's Going On, the Peace and Labor Report on WBAI 99.5 FM New York. I am Keziah Glow, and Catherine Davis is our audio engineer. Bob Henley is our executive producer. We are going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back with more interesting information. Let's take a break. We'll be right back. All right. Okay. You're back. This is WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio in New York and New Jersey, streaming live online at WBAI.org. It's 77 degrees under cloudy skies, headed up to 88 degrees by later this afternoon. Thunderstorms may be developing this afternoon. Storms may contain strong gusty winds. And Wednesday and Thursday, we can also expect rain and thunderstorms. So thanks to sustaining sponsorship from both national labor unions and some local unions representing close to 2 million rank and file members, WBAI and the Pacifica Radio Network brought you live nightly coverage of the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, and later this month, the DNC gathering in Chicago. Special guests will include diverse voices that reflect the 85 million low-wage and low-wealth voters that constitute a third of the American electorate, but have historically been left out of the national political conversation. On the ground and in the convention hall, interviews and sounds will be provided by a team of reporters from our local network affiliates in Chicago. The newscast will be co-anchored by Charlie Pittman, news director at WORT Madison, Wisconsin, and Jenna Flanagan, formerly with WNYC and WNET's Metro Focus. And of course, Bob Henley will be wandering around somewhere, I am sure. WBAI's and the Pacifica Radio Network's national political coverage is supported by sustaining sponsorships from the American Federation of Government Employees, representing 750,000 federal workers in all 50 states. 1199 SEIU, the largest union of healthcare workers in the nation, representing 455,000 members. 32BJ SEIU, America's largest building service union, representing more than 175,000 workers in 11 states and Washington, D.C. CWANJ, representing 70,000 public and private sector workers. The United Steelworkers Local 4200 represents nurses at Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital in New Brunswick, New Jersey. New Jersey's HPAE, representing 14,000 nurses and allied healthcare professionals. New York Metro Area Postal Union, APWU, AFL-CIO, Teamsters Local 210, New York City's second largest Teamsters union with a heavy presence in the airline sector across the nation's airports east of the Mississippi. AFSCME DC 37 Local 3621 FDNY EMS officers, NYC Organization of Public Service Retirees, and of course, Mike Quill's Transport Workers Union of America. We can go ahead and play that 30-second spot right now.
The Transport Workers Union fights the bosses for our 155,000 members across the economic spectrum. Airlines, mass transit, rail, school buses, bike share, tourism, university and utilities, even Central Park horse carriage drivers. I'm John Samuelson, International President of the Transport Workers Union. If you want a strong voice at the workplace, if you want to improve your life, join us. We are the TWU, America's Fight Back Union.
Okay. So, I want to hear from you. I would like for you to give us a call and share your thoughts. You can ask questions or you can, just allow your voice to be heard. The telephone number is 212-209-2877. That is 212-209-2877. And I just want to confirm our guest is on the line. We have the executive director for the Association of New Jersey Environmental Commission. And I would like to welcome Jennifer Coffey to the show. Jennifer, are you there?
I am. Good morning, Keisha.
Oh, good morning. I have to correct you too. It's Keziah.
Sorry about that.
No worries. You know what? I'm 2-0. So don't feel bad. I had to correct my last guess. It's okay. You know what? It just means that I need to do more interviews. That's all.
There we go.
So I just really want to get into. Wait, say that again. I didn't hear you.
I said, I appreciate you correcting me. Names are important.
Definitely. I definitely want to get into this conversation because, there's so many different parts to this conversation. Before we delve into the resilient environment and landscape rules, which address sea level rise, coastal storm surges, flooding, stormwater management, I'd like for you to give us an overview of what the Association of New Jersey Environmental Commissions actually oversees. What do you oversee?
Oh, it's my pleasure. So ANJAC, the Association of New Jersey Environmental Commissions, is a 55-year-old nonprofit organization. So we work primarily to help municipalities make good decisions about the environment and for healthier communities. And we know those two things go hand in hand. And at ANJAC, we're really a resource organization. We provide training, technical support, strategy support to environmental commissioners. The environmental commissioners are volunteer municipal officials that most municipalities have. There are 5 to 7 volunteers that serve on these commissions, and they advise their elected officials on all manner of issues from open space to air pollution, climate change, and ANJAC is really there for them as their resource. We work intimately with about 300 of the 564 municipalities in New Jersey.
Mm. So how are the volunteers actually chosen, and what makes them want to jump on to this?
Yeah, well, I think I'll take the second part of that question first. These are people who really care about their community. And they have made it a priority to dedicate some time each week or each month to attending meetings, being at community events, having conversations with elected officials. These are people who are usually well-connected in their communities, either through schools or scouts or seniors groups or their church or synagogue or mosque. And they really are putting in the time to talk about local policies, development, redevelopment, flooding, access to open space. They're chosen by the mayor. But usually what happens is if someone expresses interest and they start attending their EC meetings, then they can submit a resume to their mayor. And certainly ANJAC would be willing to help facilitate that kind of communication. So you can go to our website, anjac, A-N-J-E-C.org, and find information. And you can always email us at info@anjac.org. And we can help you understand if you have an EC, who's your best contact there, and if you're interested in serving on it, what that might mean for you.
That's great. That's great. We jumped right into that early on. Okay, so now I want to move a little bit further into the discussion. And, you know, how do regulatory changes enhance New Jersey's preparedness and resilience in facing current and anticipated impacts of climate change?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I really appreciate it. So in addition to my role as executive director of ANJAC, I'm also a water policy nerd, and I'm pretty passionate about clean water and healthy communities. And so I've been doing this work for some time. And anybody who lives in New Jersey knows that we need to get better with our regulations and the way that we're developing. And I say that because we're all pretty familiar with flooding these days, and we're likely to see some more of it because of Hurricane Debbie and subsequent storms. NOAA, the National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration, says this is going to be a very active hurricane and tropical storm season. And so we know that we're seeing bigger storms. We know that we're seeing more rainfall in New Jersey. And we know, by anybody who lives here or works here, that we have to stop developing in ways and in places that flood. So we have to get out of the way. We have to use better construction techniques. We have to use better safety techniques. And that's what these NJPAC real rules do, New Jersey Protecting Against Climate Threat, a Resilient Environment and Landscapes. And these rules were just proposed, just released yesterday in the New Jersey Register. We're very excited about them. We've been asking for them for 15 years. This essentially sets New Jersey up in a way to start developing and redeveloping in ways that are reflective of the climate reality that we have. Climate change is here. We're seeing the impacts. They're only going to get worse. It's high time that we recognize it and we start living in that reality. And that's what these rules are really going to do.
You know, I was actually going to ask, what is more resilient construction? Because you mentioned that. So when you say construction, what does that look like? What is resilient construction?
Yeah, so we've already started doing that in some places in New Jersey. So we updated the inland flood rules, which is by way of saying how we develop and where we develop in areas that are non-tidally influenced, so really freshwater areas. And we made some changes after Hurricane Sandy. But these rules now require really a bunch of things. I mean, there's 1,005 pages, so we could be on air for a week talking about these rules. I'm giving a pretty high-level overview of what's happening here. So they, number one, recognize where sea level rise is and will be impacting communities through the year 2100. So we're in year 2024 right now. So we're looking forward and saying this is where we know is going to be impacted by sea level rise. So we had better pay extra attention to how we develop moving forward. The how we develop is recognizing that these areas are going to flood, period. They're going to flood. And so what do we do to make people safer? And so as we develop and redevelop, we are going to elevate structures. So you cannot have bedrooms on the first floor. You cannot have living spaces on your first floor because you are going to flood, and it's a safety issue. You have to have on your first floor, if you've got garage space or storage space, that's fine. But if it's enclosed, you know, not on stilts, and we see some places on stilts, but if it's enclosed and usable space, you have to have something called breakaway walls. So when floodwaters come in, as we saw with previous hurricanes, We saw in Elizabeth and a number of people died, and those families are forever devastated. When floodwaters come in, people can be trapped. If you have breakaway walls, then you allow water to pass through and you give people a chance to get out of that space. There are additional standards on looking at moving out of the primary floodways so that you are not directly in the way of areas that we know are going to flood regularly. So it's using better materials, it's looking at the locations, and using science to inform those decisions.
So basically what you're saying is you're using scientific research data sets to influence climate policy.
Yes. And okay. It's going to take a while, even once these rules are adopted. So they're proposed right now. They're out for public comment. That means anybody who wants to can attend one of the three public hearings that are coming up in September and talk about, what they think about the rules. It's going to take time to implement these because although the game Monopoly is based largely on New Jersey, right? We've got, Boardwalk Place and Park Place and Atlantic City. We can't just pick up our homes and move them. We can't pick up our hotels and move them. So it's going to take time and redevelopment. And as we redevelop properties and communities, these rules will be implemented. And so it's really a long arc of becoming ready. And that's why it's important. Honestly, we should have adopted these rules decades ago, but we just didn't have the science to be able to write rules that would stand up to the law and stand up in the court system if needed be. But we do now. So we've got the robust science.
So when you say science, I want to get into a little bit of it. We were having a conversation and you were talking about, the consequence of when prevailing Arctic winds begin to weaken and we see collapse of Gulf Stream, ocean currents, and how those things affect the climate. Can you elaborate on either of those and show the intersection of, the flooding or more water or, how it affects this situation?
Yeah, it would be my pleasure. It's better when I do it in person because I can use hand gestures and swirling movements. But I'll do my best on radio, and everyone listening will have to tap into their imagination.
We can imagine. I was going to say that. We can imagine it.
We'll use our imagination. So New Jersey does not operate or does not experience the impacts of climate change in a silo. We're part of the larger world. And what's happening and what's affecting climate patterns and weather really everywhere is the collapse of some major global systems. And these systems are collapsing because we have put so much greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. And we have warmed these systems to the point where they're not functioning. They're not turning over as they have for millennia. And those systems, as you mentioned, one is the prevailing Arctic winds. So it should be news to nobody that it's cold in the Arctic. It is getting warmer. However, we hear about ice melting at increasingly rapid rates, and we know that the climate in the Arctic is warming. And so the prevailing Arctic winds have traditionally stayed in the Arctic. And this is where I do the whirling symbol at the top of the globe. In the winter, particularly in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, we'll occasionally have a day, two or three, where we hear our meteorologists talk about the Arctic blast that's coming in late December, January, or even February, and it gets really cold for a few days. That is also climate change. That is the prevailing Arctic winds collapsing. They're falling out of their system, and we are experiencing them for a day, two or three. That global system is starting to fall apart. The other global system that is starting to fall apart is the Gulf Stream. So the ocean current that runs from the Caribbean up the East Coast and over through the Atlantic and has major influence on weather on the eastern seaboard of the United States and UK and much of Europe. That system is also collapsing. And we hear about that stream, that those ocean currents starting to collapse. We see an article that comes up once or twice a summer, and it's pretty alarming. So with those systems, the ocean currents, the prevailing ocean currents, the prevailing Arctic wind system starting to collapse, it's causing significant changes in our weather. That coupled with the increasing temperature of our ocean and our atmosphere means that we are experiencing right here in New Jersey increased amounts of precipitation. So this is why we get those wild rainstorms, and we get 2, 4, 7, 9 inches of rain in 2 or 3 hours. We've experienced tornadoes in several parts of New Jersey. We never had tornadoes before. That was a pretty rare thing. We've had 5, 6 of them a season sometimes now. So what this is by way of saying that what scientists have done is they've taken into account these changes in global systems and said, what's it doing in my backyard now? What is this doing in the Garden State? And so now that we understand that, how these global systems are impacting weather patterns in New Jersey, we can project forward to the year 2100 with a high degree of certainty of what is going to happen in terms of increased precipitation, which translates to increased floodplains, which then can translate and has now translated into smart climate policy in the NJ Pact real rules.
I have to jump in here because I have a million questions and I have 4 minutes left. I wanted to know how this data was, how it came about, and you kind of brought that information up for us. But we're talking about New Jersey, so listeners may say, well, I don't live in New Jersey. This doesn't mean that this is just for New Jersey. New Jersey is actually the first state to do this, but this also means that other states can follow behind, right? Other states can begin to say, we want to do this for our state too. And then the other question I wanted to get into, this is important because many low-income communities are affected by these low-lying spaces. And, you know, it seems the governor is taking the appropriate steps to address the climate crisis. But however, how does this align with the DEP's recent approval of another fossil fuel burning power plant in Ironbound? And that was an already overburdened community. How does this, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, these are great questions, and I'd love to come on for another hour or two.
We only have a few minutes.
All the data and the wonky stuff I was talking about is based on NOAA Atlas 14 model, so the National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration. This data is available to anybody who has the computer and the academic brain power to be able to use it. And I've had conversations with advocates and legislators and regulators in New York and Vermont and New Hampshire who are saying, New Jersey did what? How did you do this? Because we're not the only state that needs to get climate ready. Everybody needs to get climate ready. And so they can all use this modeling data to adjust their land use regulations and make communities safer. It's imperative that we do this. I'm very proud to live in a state that is taking the lead on this, and I'm happy to talk to anybody in any state who wants to chat about this and plug them into the right people who can help them create this kind of model for their state. Secondly, you're absolutely right. Climate change disproportionately impacts low-income Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities. They live predominantly in the low-lying areas more so than their richer, whiter counterparts. You're absolutely right. And so there are going to be some hard conversations, and it's our pleasure to be able to be in a position to help have those conversations with communities that are gut-wrenching and incredibly difficult to talk about what is their future going to look like, and so that these communities can have self-determination. We're not magic. We can't make climate change stop, but we can help these communities to walk through the conversation so they can become more resilient. Regarding the fossil fuel plant, the PVFC, you're right. And the Ironbound, anybody who's ever been to the Ironbound knows that community needs no more pollution. They need a lot less. They have suffered the impacts of the pollution that has been provided economic benefit to many other surrounding communities. And ANJAC is proud to have signed on to a letter to support the Ironbound Community Corporation's opposition to the fossil fuel plant that has just been authorized by Governor Murphy in the Ironbound. I think it's the fourth in that community, in a very small community. It's not okay. It's a continued environmental injustice and burden on people who have already suffered and continue to suffer high rates of asthma, missed work days, COPD. It's not okay.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Jennifer Coffey, Executive Director of the Association of New Jersey Environmental Commissions. So you need to come back on and we need to have a full conversation so we can go into the nerd aspect, right? And then we can also go into a lot of the policy and talk about the different communities. So I would love for you to come back and have a full hour conversation.
That would be great. These are big, hairy issues, and there's a lot to say. So I know we didn't get to any callers today, but anytime you want to have me on, I would love to.
Yes, yes, yes. So, and, you know, we can have a forum on environmental racism, you know, go really deep into this because you have the data. And I just want to let the listening audience know, when I said we can have a nerd conversation, we had already established this before. So I don't want anybody to think that I'm being offensive in any way.
Oh, no, I'm a proud data nerd, proud science nerd over here.
Yeah, and we want to hear your findings. So we look forward to having you back on. I can't wait. Thank you so much, Jennifer Coffey, Executive Director of the Association of the New Jersey Environmental Commissions.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Same here. Okay, so this is Keziah Glow, and you've been listening to another episode of What's Going on the Peace and Labor Report. Coming up next is Democracy Now!, followed by tomorrow in the same spot, we're going to have Linda Sarsour on What's Going On. And, you know, thank you so much for tuning in. I really want to thank the audio engineer, Catherine Davis, and our executive director, Bob Hennelly. See you next week.
Talk to me. You can't see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on. Ooh. Right, right on. Right on.
Right on. 99.5 FM, WBAI, New York.